Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
I'm Kathy with a C.
And I'm Kathy with a K.
And this is Killer Destinations. Today's destination is St. Joseph, Missouri. Today, downtown St. Joseph is a remnant of a bygone era with its aging brick buildings and historical architecture. It reflects a simpler time when life operated at a slower pace. But 43 years ago, even though the pace was a little slower and the community was more closely knit, residents found out the hard way that the boogeyman was real.
At 4 p.m. on Thursday, July 29th, 1982, Michelle Steele's parents reported her missing. That morning, 11-year-old Michelle walked to an orthodontist appointment by herself. She was a lifelong resident of St. Joseph, Kath, and she had red hair, and she had freckles on her face, super cute little kid, and as was common in the 1980s, she felt safe in her hometown. And this orthodontist appointment, Kath, was 2 miles away. Unfortunately, Michelle never came home. Police immediately began interviewing people in our orthodontist office, and a command post was set up downtown. As word spread, tips were called in and search parties were organized. And Kath, they of course brought out every law enforcement they could think of. It was St. Joseph police officers, county deputies, the Missouri Air National Guard, Water Patrol, Highway Patrol. All of these agencies joined in on the search, as well as many residents and Michelle's family. One tip said a girl was seen walking to the river, and another said a man was following a girl out of the orthodontist office. And a third one said that she had even been seen at a local pool. And every one of these tips was investigated and documented. Now, of course, Michelle's family grew more frantic as the hours wore on and she did not return home. Search efforts went late into the night and picked up the next morning. Various groups of searchers spread out to search the river, but because the terrain near the river was very overgrown, searchers on horseback were the ones who combed the area. But then a canoeist on the river spotted a little girl's shoe and pointed it out to searchers. It had love beads strung on a safety pin that her parents had described to police as what Michelle was last seen wearing.
Do you remember those? I mean, people probably still use them now, but just like where it was cool to like put beads on a safety pin and pin it to your shirt or your shoe or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, so when I read this, I was like, oh, that poor little love,
you know. About an hour after finding these beads, Michelle's body was found by her uncle on the banks of the river. Now, Kath, he was part of a larger search group, so homicide investigators and the coroner were immediately called to the scene. It turned out that 11-year-old Michelle had been sexually assaulted and died from asphyxiation.
Michelle was described as a regular Mary Poppins and an all-American girl who never even stayed out late. She would have been in the sixth grade at Hall School and was survived by her parents, Annette and Leonard, and her brother, Jim. And Kath, when I read her obituary, it stood out to me that her grandparents on each side, I believe actually she had a total of 3 grandparents left. You know, how hard is it? When a child predeceases their parents, it's so unnatural. But I mean, it hits home so badly when it's like your grandparents are still alive and you're not, you know. Of course, she had a bunch of extended relatives as well that were just grieving her loss. And the family held a private mass and Michelle was buried at Mount Olivet Cemetery. On the same day her body was found, St. Joseph police took into custody a man they suspected of being Michelle's killer. He was a 53-year-old transient named Richard Clark. According to journalist Mark Sheehan of the St. Joseph News Press, it turned out that Richard Clark was first contacted by law enforcement the night before Michelle went missing. So, Kath, what happened was a sheriff's deputy and a reserve officer were out on patrol in Western St. Joseph, and this was right near the Missouri River. Okay. So there is a highway that runs along the Missouri River. It's 229, or it was back then. I don't know if it still is, frankly. I think it is. But anyway, so the deputies were underneath an underpass, and there was fencing next to the pillars on the freeway, and they saw movement. So they pulled the car over and they see a man. And so they're like, hey, come on over here. So he is basically camped out under the underpass. So he walks up to the fence to talk to the deputies.
Wait, I'm sorry. Was the fence separating the two of them?
Exactly.
Or the three of them, I guess. There's a couple of deputies.
Yes.
Okay.
So he comes up to the fence and he identifies himself as Richard Harris. And they asked him what he was doing. So we told him he just got to town that evening and simply went to a liquor store and bought some beer. And they asked him, what store did you go to? And he told them. And now the deputies knew that at the time he said he was at that store, the store was closed. And so they were asking him more questions. And eventually he produced bus tickets that showed he arrived in town a week earlier, and they thought it was weird, but there was really nothing they could hold him on, so they let him walk away. And so the funny thing is, Kath, in the newspaper articles that I read, there were a lot of people complaining that vagrancy was no longer illegal. Yeah, like the chief of police was saying, there was a United States Supreme Court that came down that says we can't arrest people for vagrancy. I don't like it. You know, it just was kind of funny. But
and look at the 10 cities we have now.
I know, seriously. Anyway, so the next day was the day that Michelle went missing, and this deputy who had interviewed this transient, Richard Harris, was part of a search team. And the area where Michelle's shoe and body was found was not far from where this transient was questioned.
So he wasn't part of the search team that found that stuff. It's just when he heard where it was, he was like, wait, I know there was a guy there. I talked to him.
Exactly. That's my understanding.
Okay.
And he was fishy. He lied to me.
Right.
He two stupid
for
lies.
For apparently no reason.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Lie about where he got beer and what time, and lied about being in town only one night. Anyway, so investigators set off to find this transient. And it turned out that just hours before Michelle's body was found, he had presented himself to the St. Joseph State Hospital requesting psychiatric treatment. He said he needed help. And so the police actually called around to various locations that a transient might be. For example, they called the Salvation Army. They also called the psychiatric hospital and they said, hey, have you had any recent suspicious admissions? The hospital staff said, yes, there was this man named Richard Clark who came in. So it turns out, Kath, that this was the same guy that was underneath the underpass who had lied to the deputies and identified himself as Richard Harris. So as we said, the day Michelle's body was found, Richard Clark was taken into the St. Joseph Police Station for questioning and his clothing was confiscated. 3 days later, he was formally arrested and booked into jail on first-degree murder with the enhancement of having committed a murder during the commission of a rape. His bail was set at $250,000. And one of the things that was interesting was that he refused to take part in his arraignment. He would not walk into the courtroom, so deputies literally had to carry him into the courtroom.
No way.
Yeah. And Cass, something else. Once police contacted Richard Clark, he did not speak to anyone. When he was charged with this crime, he was assigned a public defender. He did not speak to his attorney. He did not address the judge in any way. And he went on a hunger strike, not eating for over a week. He would not speak to his jailers. He would do none of that.
At the preliminary hearing, the star witness was a woman named Mrs. Rue, who testified that she worked at her husband's dental practice in the Kirkpatrick building where Michelle's orthodontist was. Sometime after 11:30 on Thursday, she was entering the building and noticed a young girl matching Michelle's description leaving the building. And the little girl was looking at the ground, and Mrs. Rue noticed that there was a man walking next to her, very close to her shoulder. Although he was not touching it, like his body wasn't bumping up against it, he didn't have his hand on it. So Mrs. Roos stopped to let them leave the building and watch them walk away before she went into the building and went to work. She said, though, that as the man walked past her, he gave her a very direct one-on-one stare and described it as a very strange stare, a haunting stare. Mrs. Roos identified the man sitting at the defense table as that man. As a result, with the other information that they had gleaned, Richard Clark was held over for trial. After his preliminary hearing, Richard Clark was still refusing to speak. So the judge ordered a mental evaluation, which was actually, Kath, going to be performed in his jail cell, which does that, I don't know if that happens.
I have no idea if it happens.
Has it happened to you?
But every time in jail, they tell me that my plea of not guilty by reason of insanity isn't going to fly.
Oh, I'll testify for you.
Exactly. But yeah, so I'm sure it's not customary to hold a mental examination in a jail. And so, but they did it with this guy anyway, and he was found competent to stand trial.
Correct. Richard Clark's defense attorney disagreed with the evaluation being conducted in a jail cell. So he asked the judge for a second assessment in a more professional setting. But the judge said, nay, nay, fair maiden.
He said, you can cry all you want, Mr. Public Defender, but the answer is no.
Eventually, though, the defense attorney's request was granted, and Richard Clark was transferred to a professional setting. Again, however, he was found competent to stand trial. He was also ordered to give teeth impressions. Prosecutors believed that marks left on Michelle's left arm were bite marks, and they wanted comparison impressions. And we all know now how that turns out with bite marks. But at the time, remember, this is 1982. This was still something they thought would be feasible. So Richard Clark actually fought with the dentist because he didn't want to do it. And the prosecution ultimately got a court order, Kath, that he was sedated to take the teeth impressions by the county medical examiner.
I guess he was trying to bite the dentist.
I would have.
I know.
But Clark, at this point, was still refusing to speak to a single person.
Newspapers revealed that the community was collectively sighing in relief after the capture of Richard Clark. But from the beginning, residents of St. Joseph and law enforcement officers were reminded of a case that happened 4 years before and was very similar. In 1978, 4-year-old Eric Christian was kidnapped from a downtown playground. His body was found in a weedy ravine not far from the Missouri River. In fact, it was less than 2 miles from where Michelle's body was found, and he too had been sexually assaulted and asphyxiated. Kath, what happened with Eric was so sad. I mean, all of this is sad, but he was being watched by his father's office worker. It was a 20-year-old girl. I don't know if she was a secretary or what, but Eric Christian, this little boy, was from a very prominent lumber family. And so this got a lot of notoriety, as you can imagine. I mean, any 4-year-old going missing will get people's attention. But this 20-year-old girl had taken Eric to a downtown mall, and they were just window shopping and having fun, and she wanted to go into this bookstore, but Eric didn't want to go. Eric was a really rambunctious and outgoing 4-year-old, and he convinced this 20-year-old to let him play on this playground with the other kids while she went into the bookstore. And she decided, yeah, it's going to be okay. I'm only going to be in there a couple minutes. So she returned minutes later and Eric was gone. The boy's body was found hours later by searchers. And so there was all of this conversation in the newspaper comparing Michelle's murder to Eric's murder. But Eric's murderer was already caught. He was convicted and was serving a prison sentence when Michelle was murdered. Okay, so back to Richard Clark. When he was originally interviewed by that deputy and that, you know, reserve deputy when they were out on patrol, and this was the night before Michelle's body was found, he told the deputy that he had been staying at the Salvation Army, but that he had been traveling all around the area as well as to surrounding states. So once he was in jail awaiting his trial, investigators started looking around, reaching out to other law enforcement agencies, and they found out that 2 years prior, he had been arrested in Lincoln, Nebraska, for molesting a 17-year-old boy in a mental hospital where Clark was also a patient. It was also discovered that he'd been arrested in Iowa the year before Michelle's murder. And this is crazy. He was accused of trying to abduct an 11-year-old boy from a grocery store. So this is crazy. And God love this 11-year-old. So he basically walked up to the boy and said, "I'm a plainclothes officer. You need to come with me." And he pulled out his ID and he showed it to this boy really quickly. So he tells Richard Clark, "I want to see it again." And when Clark would not produce it again, the boy ran.
Good for him.
I know. And so,
which probably saved his life.
Absolutely. So he told police that he thought it was a prison ID.
Ooh.
Yeah. And frankly, he was probably right. So as a result of this attempted kidnapping, Clark was caught and he was committed to an Iowa mental health facility for treatment and eventually released without supervision. So there was no criminal prosecution on this guy. And months later, he found his way to St. Joseph, Missouri, and to Michelle Steele.
Then, nearly a year later, and Kath, at this point, Clark was still continuing to keep silent. He was in the Buchanan County Jail, and this is the county in which St. Joseph is located, and he did something unexpected. He passed a note to one of his jailers and asked to speak with the FBI. So at some point after this, it actually did get to the FBI, and Special Agent Joseph Holtzlag, who was in the St. Joseph field office, went to the jail to speak with him. Now, Agent Holtzlag was not involved in Michelle Steele's investigation because it was a state crime, not a federal one, but nonetheless, he decided to meet with Richard Clark at the jail. At this meeting, Kath, Clark drew a map of the location of a body that was buried on a piece of federal land in Davenport, Iowa. Agents actually went to this location and uncovered the body of 38-year-old James Churchill, who had been missing for 2 years. In an article in the St. Joseph Gazette by journalist Paul Stewart, law enforcement was quoted as saying that Churchill's body would never have been discovered without Clark's confession because it was buried under rocks at the Rock Island Army Depot on the Mississippi River. Kath, Clark also told Agent Holtzlag about other murders. And although the agent would not confirm the number, it was reported that Clark confessed to 16 additional murders. The agent obtained as much detail as he could regarding the murders to which Clark confessed, and then turned the confession information over to the various state law enforcement agencies who were investigating those respective cases, because these weren't just cases located in Missouri, they were in other states as well. In an article by Nancy Garner of the St. Joseph News Press, about a month after their first meeting, Clark wrote a letter to Agent Holtzlag telling him that he didn't care about what happened to himself, but the man in prison for 4-year-old Eric Christian's murder had been framed. Clark admitted that he was the real killer.
Dreaming of blissful summer days and creamy popsicles? Capture sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. Just one stick and 16 ounces of water can help hydrate you better than water alone. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout.
It was reported that the chief of the St. Joseph Police Department was satisfied that they had the right guy in prison and refused to entertain the notion that anybody else was guilty of the crime. But Agent Holtzlag apparently believed Clark when he had confessed to the crime, because the agent then got involved in the effort to free Eric Christian's supposed killer.
The man serving time for Eric's brutal murder was a man named Melvin Reynolds, who was 25 years old when he was arrested. At the time of Clark's confession, Melvin had served 4 years in prison. And Kath, this is so sad when I was reading about Melvin's personal history. And a lot of my information came from a 1985 LA Times article by Richard Meyer. Melvin's parents divorced when he was young, and he was very badly affected by it. And at the age of 10, his mother couldn't handle him anymore, and she sent him to a boys' home. You know, it's like they used to have home for incorrigibles. My impression is that it was one of those. So Melvin is placed in this boys' home when he is 10 years old, and he was completely victimized in there by
He was brutally victimized.
Yes, by the older boys. And so he returned home 2 years later. His mother had remarried, but he was super sexually confused, and he stood out to his peers. They thought he was effeminate. He was teased. He was a slow learner. Basically, school was a nightmare for him, and he dropped out when he was a freshman in high school. And he would occasionally wear women's clothing. So he obviously was sexually confused. However, he started getting into petty crime. And when he dressed as a woman, he was less likely to be chased down by cops. And so, you know, there was that component to it. But anyway, so Melvin, being effeminate, suffered a lot of teasing. And there was a rumor that went around that he actually molested one of his cousins who was younger than him. But everyone in his family, including his aunt and uncle, said that didn't happen. But the point was, this guy was sort of...
He was on the radar.
Exactly. He didn't fit in. So in 1978, when Eric went missing, Melvin actually had his life a little bit on track. He had a fiance, and he participated in the search for Eric. Everyone did. Like, it was such a thing. When Eric's body was found, and it was discovered that he had been sexually molested, Melvin panicked. He knew in his heart the St. Joseph police would come looking for him. And he was right. So they pick him up for questioning, and they question him several times over a period of months. So they would just go randomly pick him up, drag him to the station, and just, you know, go at it. One of the interrogations lasted 17 hours. He submitted himself to two polygraph exams. One he passed, one was inconclusive, and he agreed to be hypnotized. And so he was questioned also under what they call the truth serum, amobarbital. And it basically, he was living, like, his life was like sort of a stasis of tension, not knowing when police were going to come and pull him in and, you know, pound him with questions and make accusations and all this kind of stuff.
And clearly they didn't believe what he'd been saying.
Yeah. And so apparently during one of the examinations, after hours and hours and hours, he slipped up. He said something like, after I killed her, I mean, after I went, you know, like one of those things. Well, man, they latched onto that. As you can imagine, detectives would. And it made them even more relentless. So finally, a few months after Eric's murder, he was brought into the station for yet another round of interrogation, this one lasting 14 hours. And finally, he basically said, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to say? They were saying things like, you want to get married to your fiance, don't you? And he's like, yeah. And he's, well, how are you going to do that with this hanging over your head? Like, he just gave up. I'll say whatever you want me to say, kind of thing. And Kath, he had no real details of the murder. So when the prosecutor said, take me to where the body was found, he totally chose the wrong location of where Eric was left. And he had alibi witnesses.
Who were the alibi witnesses? Do you know?
I don't know.
But like, maybe they weren't reliable?
Or maybe there were like some time
but where, not where it wasn't all the time.
There was a significant piece of time where he was accounted for. One of the witnesses who called the St. Joseph police when Eric went missing said that he had seen a little boy on the railroad tracks matching Eric's description, but he was walking with an older man. And it was estimated that this man was in his 60s. Well, Melvin is obviously, you know, in his early 20s. Nonetheless, Melvin confessed, and then he embellished his confession with details that were kind of fed to him, either intentionally or unintentionally, like you did this, you did that, blah, 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 blah. But Melvin never admitted to strangling Eric. In an article by the St. Louis Post-Dispatch by journalist Terry Ganey, it was reported that the jury did not believe Melvin's story about being coerced into a confession because, of course, at the time, there was not a lot of studies done on coerced confessions. And people thought, like, why would you ever admit to doing something like this to a four-year-old if it wasn't you? So he was convicted of second-degree murder. And his experience in prison was horrific. And one of the things I read was that he made the confession in the police department, which of course was admitted against him at trial. However, at trial, he took the stand and totally denied everything that happened. He's like, I didn't kill this little boy. I was manipulated. I was coerced. And one of the stories that said, I started wondering if I actually had killed him. Like he was so, you know.
Well, you're put under questioning for 17 hours one day, 14 hours another. You're being deprived of sleep, food, I'm sure water as well. And this is the kid that you described as a slow learner.
Oh, terrible.
You're not going to be able to hold on to that.
No. So he goes to prison and he was given the option of being in solitary confinement. And he said no. And he had a horrific time in prison. As you can imagine, every bad thing you imagine happening in prison happened to this poor guy. So fast forward, we now have the FBI agent trying to free him based on the confession of Richard Clark. And what's really interesting is when I started doing research for this, I couldn't find any court records. But as part of the United States Congressional Record in 1984 on methods of executions in the United States, former Governor Jerry Brown.
Former California Governor Jerry Brown.
Exactly.
Was it senior or junior?
Senior.
Okay.
Was leading the push to end capital punishment. And they were putting into the congressional record all of these circumstances where people were wrongfully convicted.
And coerced into false confessions, probably, right?
Correct. And the St. Louis Post-Dispatch article that I referenced previously with Terry Ganey was actually part of the congressional record. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Kath, one of the things about FBI agent Holtzlag's participation in Melvin's case was that the details he obtained from Richard Clark led him to truly believe that Melvin was an innocent man. And one of the things is that I said earlier, like Melvin never admitted during his confession to strangling Eric. It was never part of the details that he provided. However, they knew he died of asphyxiation. When the FBI agent was interviewing Clark, Clark specifically told him, I know how to strangle people without leaving marks. And that's what I did to that little boy. And so the FBI agent was like, what do you mean? Show me, tell me what you do. And he did, Clark did. And I am assuming it was something like cutting off the carotid, you know, basic chokehold. I don't know. But when the agent was told this information, he said, wow, this really does fit. We know that Eric died of asphyxia. Melvin never admitted it. And this is such specific information that he has to be the killer.
Once FBI agent Holtzlag had this very detailed and specific confession from Richard Clark, who admitted to being the actual killer, after 4 years of serving time in prison, Melvin was finally released. He moved in with his mother, he later married, and moved away from St. Joseph. As it turned out, the actual killer of Eric Christian and the accused killer of Michelle Steele was named Charles Hatcher. And Kath, that is the real name of Richard Clark. He'd been using an alias with the police the entire time. So Charles Hatcher pled guilty to the murder of Eric Christian, but denied killing Michelle. However, a jury disagreed, and he was convicted of her murder. And Kath, it turned out that Charles Hatcher was a serial killer. Although he was only convicted of the two murders, he admitted to a lot more.
So, Kath, one of the things I found interesting was that I kept looking through these newspapers trying to figure out why would Hatcher come forward and admit to killing Eric, but deny killing Michelle? Because he maintained his silence. There was a lot of speculation in the newspapers, But when he finally admitted in front of the judge that he was solely responsible for Eric Christian's murder, he essentially said, "I didn't kill Michelle. I was framed, just like Melvin was framed for Eric Christian's murder." And so he felt bad that somebody else was in prison for his crime, but he was insistent that the St. Joseph police were trying to frame him for Michelle's murder. But I thought it was kind of interesting. Like, he's coming forward, he's admitting to a murder to try to prove that he's being framed for this other one.
But it kind of makes sense though, right? Because of all the things that he was ever accused of or convicted of or admitted to, she was the only female. She was the only one who he never admitted to, but he was 53 years old when Michelle was killed. So beginning at a very young age, every person he preyed on was a boy.
That's true. And we'll get into that. Like, you know, we'll go through his history a little bit in a minute. And you're right. And like you said, the jury disagreed with him. And he was, you know, I'm not saying he wasn't her murderer, but what I'm saying, and I really wish I could have found court records, but the evidence that was connecting Charles Hatcher to Michelle's murder was a footprint near her murder scene.
In a muddy riverbank.
That looked, you know, that
it had first responders all around it.
She was under bushes, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so a footprint near the murder scene. And I believe they said it was either something in his possession, like some type of string or thread, where fibers were supposedly found on Michelle.
Did the bite marks ever match?
Yes, and the bite marks supposedly match. But you and I know now that bite marks are
technology.
Yeah, kind of. And yeah. So anyway, it seems to me, looking through the lens of somebody who knows, you know,
who we've done 210 cases.
Yeah, like 45 years later or whatever it is, like, okay, the evidence they had was slim, except the MO was same. It was a child who was raped and died of asphyxiation. So that was definitely in the MO of this of Eric. But you're right. She was his only female victim.
So ultimately, Kath, what this case hopefully taught law enforcement, but I'm sure it did, is that this had to do with poor mental health and a misunderstanding of sexual predation.
Exactly. Like, this guy turned out to be
a serial killer.
Yeah.
So we talked about all of these conversations that Charles Hatcher had with FBI Special Agent Joseph Holtzlag. And he actually, Kathy, went through, he being Charles Hatcher, kind of started in 1969 and went through the list of all of the people, that is young boys, who he had attacked, sexually assaulted, and killed. The first murder that Hatcher admitted to was a 12-year-old boy in Antioch, California, named William Freeman, and Hatcher admitted to strangling him. After that, Hatcher was caught beating and molesting a 6-year-old boy in San Francisco. Now, Hatcher faked mental illness to avoid prison, and he actually pled not guilty by reason of insanity. So they held him in a psychiatric hospital, and he escaped. He was caught a week later and imprisoned, but as a result of his 1972 conviction for this 6-year-old boy, he was sentenced to 1 year to life, which is an odd sentence.
I thought so too.
In a medium security prison, but he was released just 5 years later in 1977. As part of his confessions, as we said, Hatcher admitted he murdered 4-year-old Eric Christian in May of 1978, and after that, he was arrested for sexually assaulting a 16-year-old boy in Nebraska. He was sent to the Douglas County Medical Hospital and released just a few months later in 1979. So just 5 months after that, he was arrested for assault and attempted murder after he tried to stab 7-year-old Thomas Morton. He was sent to the Norfolk Regional Center, which was a mental health facility, after the charges were dropped. And then shortly after that, now we're in 1980, Hatcher was arrested as Richard Clark in Lincoln, Nebraska, for the attempted assault and sodomy of a 17-year-old boy. He then attempted to kidnap the 11-year-old boy from an Iowa grocery store, and this was a little boy who questioned his police credentials, and when he couldn't provide them, the little boy ran.
Exactly. And these are really just the
tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, these are the top crimes. In everything we read, he admitted to killing 16 people, and obviously he led the FBI to that 38-year-old man. And I couldn't read any explanation as to what happened to the 38-year-old, or I don't know if it was like some kind of bar fight. I don't know if it was actually like an attack and sexual molestation situation. But Charles Hatcher truly did have a life of crime. Like you said, this is the tip of the iceberg. And it began when he was young and he had arrests for what were some of the
stealing
things?
Stealing cars was his big one.
Stealing cars, forgery.
Right.
Dude, he got 3 years on a $10 forgery check.
And I looked it up to think, oh, maybe it's like 10 grand now or something right. like that. In today's dollars, it would be $135.
Yeah.
3 years. And actually, that's more prison than he got for some of these other crimes.
I know. It's crazy. So yeah, like forgery, auto theft. I want to say like, there was like shoplifting.
Yeah, shoplifting.
He had a lot of sort of basic stuff when he was younger. And he had 2 successful escapes, one from a mental hospital, one from a prison where he was caught again. And I believe he had a 3rd successful escape. Like this guy.
His first murder that he admitted to didn't happen until he was 31. And the car thefts and all of that started at about age 10.
Right. And you know, it's like, not surprisingly, he had a crap childhood as well.
Yeah.
You know, he saw his brother die from being electrocuted, I think, wasn't it?
He did. They were flying a kite.
Oh, yeah.
In a thunderstorm. And as his brother was about to hand the kite to him, the brother got hit with electricity from the storm and the brother died instead.
Yeah. Playing Thomas Edison.
But I think that was Benjamin Franklin, but.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
But he also, his parents divorced. His father was an alcoholic. His mom, now this is starting back, was it in the like the 1930s? Or maybe it was
when he was a kid.
Like 1950s. Mom was divorced and remarried 4 times, mm-hmm. which back then you didn't hear about that a lot.
Yeah. So he had a very unsteady, unhappy
childhood.
You know,
and as we know, stepfathers, unfortunately, or boyfriends tend to go after the kids.
You know.
Not all of them, obviously. But
right. And that's no excuse. Like, he was an adult when he was doing these things. But one of the things...
But what happened when he was little? That's my point.
Yeah, exactly. But there were occasions when he would be in prison, and I think this happened twice, where he said to his jailers, like, I need psychiatric care. I need to see someone. And they're like, no, you don't. Shut up and go back to your cell. And again,
they thought he was faking it.
Yeah. All of this is not an excuse because he was diagnosed with, I believe at some point he was diagnosed with schizophrenia and other various mental health issues. However, he was also accused of faking it.
Right. He was called a con, a malingerer, all of these things.
Yeah. But I mean,
and these are from the mental health institutions.
Yeah. But on more than one occasion, he checked himself in to psychiatric institutions and stayed for periods of time. And this case is such an example. Like, sexual predators don't change their stripes. And, you know, people didn't really know that as much 50 years ago. You know, they believed like, oh, therapy can work and this and that. Yeah, therapy can.
So can castration.
But not really. Exactly. Like, chemical castration is really where it's at. But, you know, and so it's like, it was actually difficult doing the research for this because he had such a history of sexually abusing so many people and getting caught.
So many boys. And yeah. That honestly, like, that's the thing is, you know, one of the things that Kath and I have talked about is that what we've seen as we've been doing this true crime podcast is how many people are wrongly convicted. It's tragic when you see it, right? Our legal system is not built on that. It's better to have 9 guilty people go free than 1 innocent person go to prison. But when you look at this, we're reading something that was put together by Radford University. This is a university in southwestern Virginia, and they have a department of psychology who puts together kind of a synopsis on a lot of serial killers and and mass murderers and whatnot. But one of the things they have in here is it talks about who the victims are, or actually it talks about sexuality. And in it, it says bisexual, in parentheses, last of 16 victims was female, which was the one he said he did not commit.
Right. Little Michelle Steele.
Right. That he was convicted for. Now, of course, then the question is, now, Kath and I were talking about this, too. Episode 177, we interviewed somebody who was a juror on a trial that happened in Venice, California. Super interesting case. And the California Innocence Project got involved. Well, what had happened, and I'm going to do a synopsis because if you haven't listened to it, please do. But basically, at the end of the trial, the prosecutor had gone and talked to the jurors to thank them for the work they'd done, whatever. And one of the comments the prosecutor made was, well, you know what? Just take heart because, you know, because he was convicted. This man was convicted. Even if he wasn't guilty of this one, he's still guilty of a lot of other crimes. Okay, but does that make that right? And the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
But that could be what happened in this case.
Yeah, we don't know. And we're not saying he didn't kill her.
Correct.
But it's interesting. So getting back to Charles Hatcher's convictions, for Eric Christian's case, he was sentenced to life in prison with no parole for at least 50 years. And for the murder of Michelle Steele, Hatcher requested a death sentence, but the jury refused and recommended that the judge simply impose life in prison.
Was that LWOP?
Definitely. 4 days after his sentencing for the murder of Michelle Steele, Hatcher was found dead in his solitary confinement cell at the Missouri State Penitentiary. Here's like the twisted thing that I read in the newspaper. A museum got a hold of the wire.
Mm-hmm.
They called it an electrical cord in the newspaper, as well as the shoelace that he died from. I have no idea how. And they were going to create an exhibit, and thousands of people, mostly from Missouri, signed a petition requesting that they not do so, including Michelle Steele's mother.
When you said thousands, though, you were talking like 50,000.
50,000, something like that. I believe that's what I read, 50,000 signatures, which I can't even imagine. You know, this was like in an age of door-to-door or signatures outside a grocery store. I don't like nothing online, obviously. But anyway, I tried so hard to find out if the museum actually did the exhibit, and I could find no information whatsoever in newspapers.
I wonder if there's another museum that got it, but I'm sorry, but I personally believe that that all has like evil in it.
Bad juju for sure.
Exactly.
Yep.
Why would you want to put that out there?
Burn
Why would
it.
You want to see, exactly Burn bury it?
Yep.
Throw
yep.
it in a volcano?
Exactly.
Whatever you want to do. Thank you for listening.
Thanks so much.
Don't forget, we have a free 7-day trial at the $10 Patreon level. No, and subscribe on YouTube. But just a warning, this one is not actually going on YouTube as a video too, because the person who helps us edit it is busy and she can't do it. So it's just an audio this week.
Exactly. Usually in front of our YouTube, we try to put some bloopers. So
we don't have them this year.
Exactly.
Well, this year.
This week. This week. This year.
This week.
Potato, potato.
Exactly. Same thing.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.